This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Lim Suan. Yesterday, Prime Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin announced the Pemulih Stimulus Package, or the National People's Wellbeing and Economic Recovery Package. It's worth 150 billion ringgit, of which 10 billion ringgit is direct fiscal injection, and the package involves a range of assistance for individuals and businesses. But is it enough to help individuals and households who are struggling most during this fourth lockdown that Malaysia is undergoing? So that's what we want to discuss today. And joining me on the show is Lee Hwak An, a senior fellow with the Malaysian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Asia Institute. Thank you so much for joining us today, Hwak An.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I guess first, let's look at the package generally, right? What were the highlights of the stimulus package for you? You know, what stood out?
Well, just going by its own headlines, the first focus is to continue the Prihatin Rakyat agenda. So I think the main the bulk of it is you know, just new injections into existing programs, especially with Bantuan Prihatin, these the cash handouts, and then also the wage subsidy. I mean, there is I think an addition of a category of assistance for the hardcore poor. So maybe, I mean, that's something that does stand out. And there's another renewal of EPF withdrawals, loan moratoriums as well. And then some support for, you know, job search allowances and gig economy and micro and small businesses. So, yeah, I mean, it's mainly, continuity. And of course, we bear in mind that, you know, there's a crisis that is also very much in, you know, this kind of, continuity mode. It's just prolonging, and so it's really a question of getting out assistance that we know is very basic, right? That just needs to go out.
So let's look at some of the key points that you mentioned, right? One of it was the Bantuan Prihatin Rakyat, which they said that they will add some amount to it. And then there's also extra cash handouts under the COVID-19 special aid. And that's for the hardcore poor, the B40, the M40 households and singles. And these range from 100 ringgit to 500 ringgit, which will be given out, which is set to be given out in August and December. Do you think that's sufficient to help those who need cash, and should it be dispersed earlier?
Well, I think as we speak, one of the dispersals, disbursements will be transacting supposedly yesterday, today, late June anyway. And that was announced a month ago. I mean, I think if you just look at the schedule, we have June and September was supposed to be the next for the Bantuan Khas. That's to households and singles. And they've added August and December. So, I mean, it's a question really not just of the month, but actual part when in the month that's going to take place. Because if you look at that, look at that schedule alone, I mean, July is sort of missing, but if they're going to be receiving some today, that could tide over into July. But when is the August payment? Is it late in the month or early? I guess one will hope that it will be early. But then if you continue looking at that schedule, then, you know, you just wonder whether there are particular gaps. So in terms of the timing, in terms of the targeting also, I mean, I just wish that there was a bit more clarity. You know, there's this B40 category. It's sort of, you know, just some kind of it's being used really very loosely as a catchphrase. Mm-hmm. The cutoff that has become established, you know, in the past year since Prihatin is 2,500 for per household. Based on the income distribution, what we know from 2019, the household income survey, I know the B40 cutoff point for, this is, to be clear, gross income. So it includes all you know, various sources of income and multiple earners in a household. But, you know, that's at 4,800. So that's that means households below 4,800 were classified as B40. So yeah, we just you know, wondering about how this targeting is now being operating and how many are benefiting, and whether or not that 2,500. What is the basis for that 2,500 that's been used since last year? And also the not much clarity on the house hardcore poor, mm-hmm. How that will be targeted. But if we look again at another household income report from 2019, now that in that there was an exercise that reevaluated the poverty line income. So that's the poverty, that's the household income, and it's on a basis of an average household of four members. So for determining whether a household is poor or not, and that's based on an assessment of a minimum amount of food and basic needs, and the poverty line income based on that exercise was revised upward to 2,200, and the hardcore poverty line was about half of that at 1,040 a month for a household of four, and that's only 0.4% of the population. I mean, we don't really need to quibble so much about this at this point. I think it's more about, you know, getting need to the households in need. But it's a phrase again that's been used in the Prime Minister's speech and this hardcore poor. But we're just not sure again, you know, how it's being targeted, and therefore it's a bit hard to evaluate the adequacy of the amounts, and as well of you know, how effective this reaching out to those in need.
And just to briefly touch on that, you know, I have seen a number of people point out how that B40, M40 category may not necessarily be enough anymore to describe who needs aid or, you know, the situations that people are in. Last week, I spoke to Dr. Madeline Burma, and she was also sharing her thoughts on how it is useful to sort of simplify who needs aid and who doesn't, but it doesn't take into account a lot of things, right? Like you say, it's the household income. Do you think then, you know, we need to sort of revamp how we categorize people and how, and thus who needs aid?
I think those are you know, yeah, discussions that can take place after, you know, and I think take lessons as well from the past year, but this past year and a half, right, it's been a shock. I think the more important thing is not so much the income level, but those who have taken a setback, who have lost income, who have lost jobs. Of course, you know, it is also relative, right? How much relative to the previous income that you had, and how much, you know, reserves or you know, how much other sources they can draw on, and so on, right? So I think we do have, moving forward from here, yes, you know, some serious discussions that need to take place, and the usefulness of these categories. I mean, I think these are just labels that are for the greatest the greater need of lower income. You know, that would have less begin already with less income, and so they have less of a buffer if they have, you know, suffered loss of income. That's the B40, you know, the M40, you know, is the next category, and that would also include those that are neither here nor there. So they can also, right, be in some dire straits because not really qualifying for the assistance that targeted at the B40, but they may have suffered, you know, serious setbacks as well, right? So even though their standard of living, right, would be a bit more comfortable, but mm-hmm. again, it's a question of, yeah, how much of a shock they've had to absorb in the past year. I think, yeah, we can talk about, you know, how to the overall the structural issues. I think getting through the crisis first, though. Yeah.
So then on that note of cash handouts, right, some people have said that, you know, there should be more cash handouts, while others saying that shouldn't be the focus. I mean, what's your take on it?
Well, I mean, I think we can see a bit more from journalistic accounts, anecdotally, you know, there is still this kind of a disconnect, right, between the macro statistics that are not really showing as severe an impact and even some kind of, you know, recovery momentum through things like the unemployment rate. So I think that's also signaling another issue to look into more seriously. Not just after recovery, but I think in the present, because let me just touch on this. One thing that was interesting was revealed within the Pumule package speech is that the EPF, right, is a bit cryptic, but it mentioned that based on EPF and SOXO data, you know, 1 million members have had, you know, loss of income. Presumably, this is because they have stopped being able to make the contributions. That's a very staggering number, and it's, you know, far exceeding the unemployment figures that we have. So, yeah, that's really something to. I wish that there was also a bit more clarity, because the EPF intervention is quite major. But I think for cash handouts, you know, the bigger needs that we can see being reported, and I think not picked up in a lot of the data, because those depend on surveying to do more randomly, whereas, you know, there are more pronounced difficulties in pockets, right, of, you know, in urban areas, I think, where it's really quite severe. And so, yeah, the it's just a question of, you know, livelihoods and survival at this point. And I think it's also the broader picture of the economy, right? This is money that will be, when dispersed and received, will be spent, assuredly, to boost aggregate demand. So, you know, it's pretty standard, right? What the kind of macroeconomic fiscal policy that takes place.
So we'll just go for a very quick break now. I'm speaking to Lee Hock An, Senior Fellow with the Malaysian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. And we're talking about the Pumule Stimulus Package, which was announced by the Prime Minister yesterday. We'll continue our discussion after a quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. On the line with me today is Lee Hock An, a Senior Fellow with the Malaysian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute, and we're discussing the Pumule Stimulus Package that was announced yesterday evening by the Prime Minister, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, and we're discussing how, you know, we're discussing the key points of the package and how it will help individuals who are needing that financial assistance at the moment. Now, before the break, Hock An, you mentioned, you brought up EPF, right? And that is also part of the current stimulus package, where the government will allow people to further withdraw up to 5,000 ringgit from their accounts under the iCitra scheme. How concerned are you over the impact this would have on people's retirement savings when, you know, we already have EPF withdrawals being allowed previously under iCina and iLestari? And what are your concerns here?
Yeah, I think I join, you know, the growing chorus of grave concern about this. I mean, this is something, you know, problems that will manifest maybe 20 years' time, you know, but the concern, I think, needs to begin today, because it's about the foregone the dividends, you know, over 20, 30 years. And I think this is where, you know, there's been an abject lack of transparency and accountability about the iLestari and iCinar. I mean, we just know the total amounts. And that also kind of scrapped and there pick up from media reports. That's what I managed to do, gather that this was 80 billion of iCinar and iLestari combined that's approved, and up to May, 60 billion has been dispersed. So I think we need the facts about, you know, the who some profile of you know the EPF members. I gather that they're more middle or 30 somethings, 30 and lower income earners. So, you know, that's a very important, these are very important facts. And perhaps this is, you know, one of the outcomes, you know, where in the past, some of this information, you know, has been disclosed through parliamentary questions and replies. So without the House convening, you know, that's one less avenue. I mean, I think some of these need not go through Parliament. You know, they should be quite easy. They should be availed, right? You know, through just a commitment to democratic governance and transparency. I mean, I would want to, on this note, you know, make one commendation, but at the same time, it's then kind of attached to a critique. But last year, I was following the wage subsidy, and it was updated, the recipients, you know, almost every few weeks. And that was very helpful information. We were able to, you know, and it was a good act of disclosure of public information. So, you know, the 2.1 million workers that were receiving it, and it's a 200,000 plus. You know, do some analysis about that. But that has stopped since January. So we also don't know about what has changed about the profile of wage subsidy. So I think, you know, it is a learning process in a way, and some need for, you know, growth and experimentation and new pieces of information that have to be disclosed. But we have this mix of some, in some areas, you know, or last year especially, a bit more openness and a more accountability to release information like the wage subsidy. Now, that has also stopped this year. I think there's a marked change this year, and you have this EPF you know, huge. It is probably that would actually be the biggest injection if it is 60 billion that has been dispersed to accounts. And how has that factored into the government's analysis of the situation and its planning? I mean, if it was really that that amount, and are we, you know, and the government has been relying on this injection into the economy, right? Then we really need to know how what is their thinking, and then why proceed further with Chitra when, you know, Sinar has been so massive. But we have very little data because it's still in the government's hands, you know, to really say something a bit more substantive, except that, you know, our concerns are very, very grave. If they are mostly, you know, not really the senior age that would be withdrawing some EPF soon anyway, but if it is those who are still, you know, young in the workforce, and they're taking out, you know, much or most of their savings so far, maybe over already accumulated savings of 10 to 15 years, and they were supposed to have been accumulating those dividends for mm-hmm. another, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, that will be a huge problem in about 20, 30 years' time.
That's been what we've been hearing, right? The concerns that over what we might see, not now, but decades down the line, when the people who are currently withdrawing that money then retire and have little to no savings to rely on. Let's also talk about the moratorium. You know, the government also announced a six-month moratorium for individual borrowers, for micro-entrepreneurs. And this was a move that many people have been calling for the past few months now. How much do you think this will help people who are already struggling financially? Are there finer details to this move as well that we need to pay attention to?
Yeah, I think this one, they went kind of with a big bang approach. I mean, I think that is also understandable, and some have been calling for that. You know, you want to have just take rapid action, and with, you know, millions and millions out there, you know, we can't be examining case by case and so on. So, I mean, I think still with some discretion for those who choose not to, you know, to be able to exercise that. I think it's a positive move. I mean, most of the measures taken are not ideal, right? They do have longer term consequences. But I think, you know, hearing a lot and seeing the reports and these accounts of businesses really, you know, just scraping the bottom of the barrel, drawing on their cash reserves. That, you know, yeah, I mean, I think it's something that would be welcome and should be supported.
What are the possible long-term concerns over a moratorium like this?
Well, I think it's not so severe like the, you know, EPF, you know, because it's a question of a few months. I don't know how many more it might add, right, in total, you know, but it's also about viable businesses that are servicing loans, right? So it's really just to relieve the pain and yes to the current struggles and would entail, yes, you know, servicing the loans a bit longer. But it's not about as serious as the EPF, which is depleting a stock, right? A stock that was meant to accumulate. Yeah. Mm.
So then do you think then we're doing enough to address things like inequality and income gaps and preventing them from further widening as people continue to grapple with the consequences of the pandemic and the restriction measures?
Yeah, that is that's a very complex issue. I mean, I think what we sort of more applying logic and maybe also just extrapolating from what we can see about the impacts of the pandemic. I mean, in general, you know, those who can adapt better, you know, to working from home, you know, through to shifting to online e-commerce, are also already better positioned, right, in more secure in terms of having the skills, in terms of having the broadband access and so on, and more reserves as well, right, to tide over when they're with the shutdowns or slowdown. So it's expected, yeah, you know, these kind of trends would predict that inequality might rise, you know, as well, considering that, yeah, some of the worst affected are the lower income. I mean, I think that concern should already factor into the policy, the responses now, and I think that is reflected in you know a lot of assistance being targeted at the lower income. The longer term impact, you know, it's going to be a bit harder to say with any kind of certitude, and as well. Inequality is, you know, is very difficult to measure on a whole national scale, and I think we would be due for only around 2022. But in a way, that is quite providential timing, because that's next year would be the year. I think the next round of the household survey is scheduled probably then. It would be, you know, well timed, right, to have an assessment about what's happened to inequality. Yeah.
Hmm. We've spoken about a few of the key aspects of the Pemulih package that a lot of people have been discussing, but there are also other things like assistance to people who have lost their jobs, electricity bill discount, wage subsidies and things like that. But overall, how well do you think this package addresses the concerns that people in the lower income groups are having?
Yeah, I think... We can see, right, that there is a responsiveness to concerns. I mean, I guess some would say it's, you know, a bit delayed, but it's nonetheless, it appears that food, right, even food, household food security, it appears the support for job searches, right, and those kind of allowances, training and so on, are there. I mean, I think most of this is also continuity. There was this continuation of a Malaysianization with a tweak that reduces the qualifying mark from 1,500 wages salary a month to 1,200. I think this is reflecting, yes, that, you know, there has been a learning process with very low uptake of that program to make a change. But I wonder, I think, you know, yeah, we. It's sometimes it's too very easy to be very critical, you know these sort of armchair critics, but we can see that, yeah, there's been attention to a broad range of issues and concerns. I think you know, we do have is a very, it is, you know, the conversations do tend to take a very political, have political flavor, you know, but there is a whole government machinery, a bureaucracy, right, that is also attending to this. And I think that also needs to be acknowledged. There are, I think, learning along the way. But I think on, especially on this one, like the Malaysianization, you know, to basically hire Malaysian workers in place of a job that was formerly held by a foreign worker, probably we will need to go even further, right? Because it's not just, I think, about the wages. I think that can probably will be the next step in the learning process. That is just also about the work conditions. And so if it's going to be about, okay, just, you know, hiring more Malaysian workers, but, you know, working all the kind of overtime that has been expected of foreign workers, you know, who are, you know, more vulnerable and more willing or can be compelled, right, to accept those kind of very hard, long hours. These are conditions that, you know, our Malaysian workers, you know, must tolerate. And it's not in line with Malaysia's development trajectory, our development vision for, you know, to be a country, right, where there's not just a quantity of work, but quality of work. So replacing, you know, foreign workers with Malaysian workers, I mean, it's something that I think is worth exploring, but I think we're also still, we will probably still keep finding out that it's not going to be a simple switch. Mm-hmm. And not just about wages, but also about work conditions. And these could be some of the things that, you know, can hopefully, I think, you know, prompt a deeper examination about the structural issues in the economy and in the labor market.
I'd like to touch on something you briefly mentioned. You know, you said that some people might say that this package was delayed. I mean, what are your thoughts on the timing of it, right? Could something like this have been announced earlier, or was this, you know, still acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, I think Pemerkasa 2, right, was very underwhelming. And I think it's probably a lot of the reaction to this Pemulih is along the lines of, you know, why didn't just a month ago have done this at the time, you know, of the lockdown that was meant to be, you know, to provide the coverage and assistance for the lockdown. Of course, yeah, I mean, hindsight, it's easier to say, you know, the hope was probably that the infection numbers would come down and that, mm-hmm, the lockdown, you know, could have been more effective and brief. I don't dwell too much, you know, not too much on you know, whether it was, should have been done earlier or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what's more important, especially, you know, at this time and given the experience that we have accumulated, right? I mean, because there is, okay, there's been new injections, right? So that's, you know, fine. And it's sort of a response to circumstances. That's okay. That if a month ago, not enough was allocated, and now there's a bit more of a top up. That's okay. But, you know, there's still the lack of some of these very important the information, the lack of transparency, especially on the EPF ICINA and Air Lestari. You know, I think, and the 1 million of income reported as based on EPF and SOXO have lost the income, right? I mean, it's just like one brief paragraph. I think we really need to know more about that.
Hmm. So then, do you see Pemulih as a stopgap measure, or do you see it as one step towards putting our economy back on track?
I mean, who is to say what would be, which one is the final? You know, I mean, as I said, I think, you know, there is much more continuity. Right, a re-injection of funds, which I think is moving the economy, you know, towards recovery. We're talking about also, though, it's interdependent, right, with the COVID situation and the vaccination. Yeah, so, you know, there's still it's still uncertain and unpredictable. There are unpredictable elements. There's still a lot that, you know, is within the government's control, and do need to get the political, you know, volatility is not helping. You can only hope that, you know, the country will need less of these interventions, you know, but it's way too soon and I think too speculative and reckless to just say that, look, we're underway and this is going to be the last.
Mm.
There's no way you can say that. Yeah.
So on that note, then, what sort of aid would you like to see in the future, you know, especially if we have, if there is a need for another stimulus package, what can be done to help people, especially in the lower income brackets?
Well, I think it will depend on the situation. I mean, if, you know, if it is about still lockdown or whatever variation of that semi-lockdown, and if microenterprises, you know, continue to be unable to operate or have much reduced operation, you know, then maybe better targeting, but it's really still about getting cash into the people who need it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a question of human rights and dignity and decency and livelihoods. I think we should be doing better though with so that's on more of the self-employed and I think some of the lowest income classes and some that have no working person in the family that are also quite, you know, senior, right? And so I think continuity in the assistance, you know, of cash assistance, you know, needs to continue. I think this is also really stimulating conversations about what can be a more, you know, permanent features. But of course, that's something that, you know, really maybe can talk about now, but cannot really cement it now. Things like, you know, more basic income or you know, I mean, continuity really with but improvements of, you know, Bantuan Sara Hidup, which is already in place. But the wage subsidy, I mean, this is one thing also that, you know, has proven to be, I think, effective. And is something that, you know, could be also reconfigured as something, you know, that can be, you know, a backup, right? That is always on standby in case of this similar emergencies in the future. Or maybe, right, with some lessons learned about a means to, you know, to promote promote employment, to steer economy in certain direction of, you know, types of jobs that we want to implement. But we would have to really learn better, I think, because just continuing it now, I do wonder about how effective it is in this round, where it's still, I see, drawing on the same database, which is largely from last year's registrants,
mm-hmm.
For wage subsidy, most of whom, you know, employing less than 75 didn't provide the means, you know, the reasons, right, for, or didn't have to provide the grounds in terms of business losses and so on. I think right now there is a bit of urgency and so much flux that even the wage cutoff, right, the salary that used to be wage subsidy only for employees paid under 4,000, that has been waived as well. So it's become a little bit more expensive and open. I mean, some of that is understandable, right? But I think we've had enough time, I think, to learn some lessons and to be more targeted based on sector in terms of the wage subsidy. And I think maybe to offer again, you know, more than just a flat 600, but something that is proportionate to the size of the enterprise, right, or the sector.
And before we end, Håkan, you know, the largest stimulus package that we've actually seen so far was the first one, the Prihatin stimulus package, right? Can the government afford another stimulus package down the line if restrictions continue?
Yeah, comparing the stimulus packages is a bit of a perilous exercise. I mean, surely that one was the largest, right, Prihatin, I know, because that was the very first. Was also, I think, at a it had a longer time frame, so a lot of the allocations there were also applicable, right? Allocated for a few months. You know, to sort of compare that with some of the others that had a 1 or 2 month, you know, time frame, we have to factor all that in. But I think the broader picture, right, is I think firstly about, you know, national priorities and what is essential, what are really non-negotiable if it comes down to people not having enough to eat and to sustain their livelihoods. And I think this is, you know, the conversation that's also that's happening globally about how countries, right, need to rethink how they operate, rethink in terms of, you know, economic security for the population. I think that that commitment governments must not, and societies must not waver on that, and look at the bigger picture about macroeconomic conditions, economic growth. If you need to stimulate economic growth, as you know, then and that generates, you know, the longer term returns along in terms of, you know, a viable economy in terms of households' survival, right? These are all, you know, again, coming back to the core issues. And you look at the broader, you know, balance sheet of the government, you know, I don't think it's really as dire as it's made to be. And something that, you know, at this point also to bring up, you know, how Parliament, right, you know, should be having, you know, its deliberations about this issue, the broader fiscal issue and government spending and debt.
All right, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today, Håkan.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to join you.
I've been speaking to Lee Hwok An, Senior Fellow with the Malaysian Studies Program at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute, about the Pemulih Stimulus Package and whether it does enough to help Malaysians who are needing it more. So if you missed any part of today's show or other Live and Learn episodes, you can look them up on bfm.my or on the BFM app. I'm Lim Suen, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.